We have, via Skype, coming to us live from Ottawa, the angriest pothead in Canada, Russell Barth. Hello, Russell.
Hello.
How are you this evening?
I'm doing pretty good, Ed.
Yeah, it looks like we got a fairly decent Skype connection here. I'm pleased with that. We've taken a bit of a risk here, throwing you on the air without any test ahead of time, but it sounds like it's sounding okay. You hear me okay?
Perfectly clear.
Okay, excellent. Well, thanks for joining us this evening. Just going to give our listeners a little bit of context here. Amongst the many election promises during our last federal election campaign was one coming from the Liberal Party about addressing once and for all the perpetual question of cannabis, marijuana, and how to deal with the order from the Supreme Court, I guess, to deal with it and to stop having people being charged with frivolous offenses, damaging their records and causing them problems, getting hired and all sorts of things, and deal with it once and for all. And the now Prime Minister Trudeau took it on and said he would actually deal with it. And so many, many people across the country are, I was going to say holding their breath, but I guess we stopped holding our breath a long time ago, but are waiting for some concrete results and something concrete to point at. In the meantime, Russell, it seems that we may be in a kind of cannabis limbo. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, that is an accurate description. What's interesting is I get talking to people, usually on the bus, about this, and, you know, a lot of people might remember when abortion was legalized in Canada.
Yes.
And they think, oh, you know, and some people say, well, they never should have done that. And I have to point out, well, they didn't legalize abortion. The ban against having or giving a safe abortion was struck down by the Supreme Court.
That's a really important distinction, eh? That it's not an actual act of legalization that's taking place, but just removing a really, really old, archaic barriers, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So the same thing happened when same-sex marriage at the turn of the century. You know, the Supreme Court struck it down, and then the government actually did legislate it after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Slapdash legislation that seemed to work out pretty well anyway. So.
And so the same thing applies to the cannabis laws.
Well, yeah, it does, because in 1999, 2000, there was a case called the Parker case. And the judge ruled that until such time as the government put forth a workable medical marijuana access program of some kind, marijuana was off the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. It was completely unregulated.
This would be Schedule 2, I guess, right?
Right. So the court gave the government a year to sort it out because it was, you know, a task. So a year later, the government fourth NMAR, and we're sort of like, ta-da, here we are, we complied with the Parker ruling, and then it didn't really, so there was some problems with it, and it was dragged into court again, and that was the Hitzig case. So it was ruled unconstitutional in part, and then there were seven more rulings against MMAR. So in 12 years, MMAR was dragged into court 9 times, was found unconstitutional in whole or in part, mm-hmm. all 9 times. 2014, they changed MMAR to MMPR. That's with the big growers like we have in Smiths Falls and you know, the big commercial growers.
And remind us, Russell, what that acronym stands for, medical marijuana?
Medical Marijuana Production Regulation.
Production Regulation, okay. And
Something like that, yeah. Or Marijuana Medical Production Regulations.
Yes, okay.
So, you know, that allows these big companies who have, you know, large greenhouses or large indoor facilities like the one in Smiths Falls to produce marijuana and mail it to people, to the patients. And there's some paperwork to fill out. And there's dozens of these companies across the country now. Some are small, some are gigantic. And there was just a report came on my desk this morning saying that there's 10 tons of it sitting on shelves waiting to be sold to patients.
Oh, my goodness.
So while many of my friends are sick and starving for medicine, and my wife and I are rationing medicine, this stuff is sitting there waiting for somebody to pay $5 or more per gram for it.
So, and what's the reason for this? Because of this hang-up in the legislation?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. It's because of... well, also, it's the reaction to the legislation. I mean, when MMPR came in 2 years ago, court cases were struck, you know, were started against it right away. First was the Allard ruling, which we just got back in March. Neil Allard, you know, challenged the government, and MMPR was found to be unconstitutional because it doesn't allow for home grows and things like that. And a few other provisions, mainly home growing and you know, home processing. So the judge said, no, people should be allowed to grow. And the government has until August 24th to come up with some new either MMPR regulations or reinstate the MMAR regulations alongside MMPR. And they have to, you know, comply with the ruling and allow for home grows and stuff. And there's rumors already from some lawyers we've talked to that they're going to just say, oh, yeah, you're allowed to grow, but only six plants. So that means it'll be dragged back in court again.
And that part of it will be challenged.
Well, yeah. So the thing is, the government knows, too, that it can break the, you know, if you or I don't comply with a court ruling, a bench warrant is served and we are taken to, you know, to the remand center.
Yes.
The government knows that when it doesn't comply with a ruling, even one from the Supreme Court of Canada, there are no consequences. No one's going to lose their job. No one's going to go to jail. No one's going to have to pay a fine. All they have to do is take our money and use it to fight us in court.
It's a little frustrating.
It's extremely frustrating. I mean, every day people think, oh, you know, marijuana activism, that's so fun, because you see pictures of people with huge joints on Parliament Hill, or, you know, wearing marijuana leaf suits with marijuana leaves all over them.
Yes.
You think, wow, it must be fun being a pot activist, but mostly it's just daunting. You know, it's a lot of downtime, and then there's a lot of, you know, one of my biggest problems is trying to explain this to reporters, because when I tell them about the whole, you know, remember abortion, remember same-sex marriage, they manage to follow it. But then when I try to explain to them about how there's now 11 court rulings against the government's medical regulations, which technically means marijuana is, as it's more legal than peas, there are completely no regulations. It's completely off the books at this point. And, you know, some people think I'm crazy, especially reporters seem to think I'm crazy. But a few years ago, I was talking to Eugene Oscapella, who is a drug law specialist. He's a professor at Ottawa U. So I ran this past him. I said, well, you know, considering there's been, you know, at this time it was 9 rulings. I said, considering there's now 9 rulings against MMAR, doesn't that just bring us back to Parker and you know, pot's as legal as tomatoes?
Yeah.
And he sort of thought for a few seconds, and then he said, yeah, but, you know, get a judge to admit that.
But in the meantime, are there any charges sort of being pushed through the court system right now, like for the dispensaries and that kind of thing?
Well, what usually happens is somebody has to get busted and then they have to challenge the laws.
Right.
So if this is why the dispensaries are open, and I was just talking to John Oakley about this yesterday morning.
Yeah, I heard that interview.
Because people are kind of scratching their heads. Well, why don't they just shut these things down? They're literally selling marijuana out of a storefront, which has to be illegal. Why are the cops not just shutting them down?
Yeah.
And the reason is the Crown lawyers know as soon as these people get bail, they're going to be back doing it the next day. And then they're going to fight the charges in court because they're going to challenge the actual law. They're going to challenge the constitutionality of the law. They're going to challenge the medical regulations. You know, the MMPR only serves about 10,000 Canadians. The dispensary systems are serving over 100,000 Canadians.
Is that
10
right?
10 times the amount. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
And, you know, aside from maybe somebody complaining that they would like a better price, there haven't been complaints of, you know, product recall or people getting, you know, getting burned by their dispensary. And, you know, it's patients come in, they ask for some advice, they get their product, they use it. Pretty much everybody's happy with it.
So that system is working really well.
The dispensary system is working really well. And much like the abortion situation, it's self-regulated. The medical establishment regulates abortion procedures the way they regulate every other procedure. And it's been working out.
Hmm.
Whatever your views about abortion are, that's the situation legally.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
And same with same-sex marriage. So, but that's been legislated with this. If the dispensaries, there should be some regulation, but the government, we know they're going to over-regulate. They're going to make a lot. I mean, we can see what they've done out in Vancouver already.
Yes.
You know, they make the regulation so incredibly onerous. And it's really absurd because they're like, oh, these places have to be 300 meters from a school. It's so unrealistic. Kids buy marijuana at school.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, you ask, when I was a teenager in the 80s, when, you know, all the way since then, people have been able to buy marijuana quite easily from a schoolmate. It's always been the case. And, I mean, you could put vending machines in full of marijuana in schools and they wouldn't have any more access than they have now. Kids have completely unfettered access to marijuana. This is why I'm a proponent of selling it like chocolate in convenience stores or wherever we sell chocolate to people of all ages.
Hmm.
Because if the nice guy inside the convenience store is not allowed to sell marijuana to your kids or marijuana cookies or whatever, there's going to be some creep standing out in the parking lot who are more than glad to.
That's right. Some nasty guy is going to sell it.
Right. And the thing is, maybe he's just your friendly neighborhood pot dealer, and that's good news if that's what it is. Yeah. But a lot of times, especially if you live in urban areas, a lot of times these guys have things other than pot. They're like, oh, sorry, little man, I'm out of pot tonight, but I do have some speed, or I have some ecstasy, yes. or I have some coke, yes. or I have some LSD, or mushrooms, and I'll take, you know, sexual favors or stolen goods in lieu of cash. You know, this is the kind of thing that you're throwing. If we don't sell marijuana to teens, like chocolate or cola or, you know, Red Bull, which a 10-year-old can go in and buy a can of that, yep. which is far more dangerous than a couple of joints would ever be. You know, if we don't sell like that, then we're throwing our kids to the wolves, basically, to the people who are going to be, you know, and Bill Blair and Justin Trudeau, they're talking about, you know, stiff penalties for those who sell to minors. That's not a deterrent. That's an incentive. Huh. That's why marijuana is lucrative now, is because people face fines and repercussions and sometimes even jail for producing or trafficking or possessing it.
Yeah.
If it were completely off the books, it would be about, you know, $8 a pound, and it wouldn't be a commodity that people want to sell or that, you know, people want to steal or kill over or certainly deal in the black market.
You make a good point. It's actually the war, the famous war on drugs that has really driven up the scarcity or the price anyway, and exactly. the entire infrastructure, often criminal element that has flourished
exactly.
under those
laws. What we're seeing with the dispensaries and stuff now, and I mean, you can buy stuff online too. You don't even have to go to a dispensary. You can deal with them online, and they'll mail stuff to you. Yeah. My wife and I have been on marijuana charity for the past 2 years or so, and people mail us stuff all the time, huh. you know, because yeah. we're in need.
What I hear you saying,
so
Russell, is
to have people do this for us.
Yeah, know? Yeah, yeah. But what I was going to say, Russell, is that what I hear you saying is that the reality has evolved to a certain level that is fully functional and practical and like as you say, self-regulating, and it's just time for the legislators and the enforcement officers to sort of catch up with the times and catch up with the reality, and stop trying to impose these arcane rules and mindsets onto the situation. Just back off and let it happen. Is that basically the summary of what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is the problem: is the government. It's not just about it being a commodity or that it's a psychoactive substance. It's the kind of psychoactive substance that makes one question the government and become sort of nonconformist, and you know it has that tendency, not in everybody who uses it, yeah. but it does sort of have that tendency.
Yes.
So unlike alcohol or tobacco, it's, you know, it's actually quite a bit of a motivator. People think it makes, you know, that it's a motivational for a lot of people, and for a handful of people they're going to just sit and get couch locked, but most of the stoners I know are very active people. And
that's a good
you know they're
point.
Very busy, and they're yeah. getting up and they're having a few dabs right there first thing in the morning.
Yeah,
and they're off to do their job, and they're, you know, riding their bicycles and doing things.
Yes, you know? You may be a good shining example of that. Actually, you may be the poster
well,
boy for getting things done in that.
Well,
domain.
I try. You know, I mean, I'm working on this new show now, Pottawa, which is kind of fun. We go out every Tuesday night to the local vapor lounge, and
oh, yes.
we try to do a live broadcast from there.
Is that right? Oh, good for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, cool. I mean, you know, we could just tape a podcast and then, you know, chop it together and upload it, but we'll try to do a live.
Doing it live is a lot more fun. We're live right now. We're streaming live out of the review offices right now as we speak, and you're right. It is a lot more fun.
I worked at the review, it was over on...
I was just going to say, just before a little bit of a tangent to what we're talking to, but you have very direct connections with the review and with Bankley Kill. Tell us what your connections are.
Well, in, I guess it was 1988... 87, I was in this thing called the Futures Program.
Okay, yeah, I remember
that. I was
that.
Keen on photography, so I managed to get an internship there that was paid. I got paid minimum wage by the government to go and learn the ropes
yeah.
working at the review. And this is when it was over behind Lavoie's, the restaurant out there. On, I guess it's on High Street or whatever.
Yeah, 41 High Street is where it used to
right,
be.
Right, right,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
So I learned all the darkroom stuff from this guy named Germain. And then I finished my time there, my sort of, you know, 3 months or whatever it was, and went on to another job. Then I got a call one night, and they said, yeah, you know, Germ died, so we're wondering if maybe you want to do the darkroom.
Oh, is that right? Holy smokes.
And I didn't quite know what I was doing, so it was kind of like being thrown into a MASH unit. You were just like, boom, here. And I mean, we're talking Monday and Tuesday nights where it's all crammed, you know, a whole week's worth of work is crammed into 2 days.
Yeah, it's still like that.
I know, it's still like that, exactly. So, yeah. And this is when I had to use the big graphics camera and I was developing a 35 millimeter film.
Yes, yes.
So that happened from about 88 until 1990.
Okay.
And then I was gone to Toronto for 9 months and then I started back up again. That's when I met Louise Sproul.
Yes, still the owner, publisher and, of the review. Yep.
Exactly. And she was just in the process of buying it at the time. Like it was changing hands when I came back in 91.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're until 93 and then I moved away again. Okay. But I was also the cartoonist for a while.
Oh,
so
I was
the editorial cartoon for 17 or 18 months, I guess it was.
So quite deep roots with Vanclick Hill and with the Review, our local newspaper here. That's quite interesting.
Yeah,
and so,
for sure.
And you've gone off to Ottawa and made something of yourself.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say that, but you know, I have had some interesting accomplishments. I mean, I managed to I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, you know, sort of 1998-99-ish, okay. And in 2001 I had a back spasm that sort of put me in bed for months. It wouldn't let go. Normally they work themselves out in about a week, but this one just wouldn't let go. I became quite atrophied. So that was in November of 2001. So by April, I was using a wheelchair pretty regularly.
Oh, my goodness.
And so they got me a mechanical wheelchair, and I was using that for most of my transportation for 5.5 years. And
wow.
And they sort of, you know, we went to this rehab place and everything, and they were like, oh, well, you know, your diet's good, and you're trying to stay active, so that's good and everything. And I said, well, you know, maybe if I had, for lack of a better term, a big pile of weed, I could, you know, get into that sort of nice zone, and I could maybe extend my distance with my walker and, you know, this kind of stuff. And they gave me a look sort of like, yeah, you know, I suppose. And then they pulled my, you know, Christine aside, my wife, like, in, you know, in another room, and they're like, forget it. No, he's being totally unrealistic. This is his life now. Get him used to the chair because he's going to be harboring these dreams. It's just going to make things harder for him.
You mean they wanted you to stop dreaming that things could get better?
Yeah, like I was so atrophied. I was like 130 pounds and I'm 6 feet tall.
Right.
And I could walk maybe 100 feet with my cane, but it was like I was carrying a television, you know.
My
goodness.
Just
pain and non-responsive muscles. So they were like, this is his life. But they didn't tell me that. They didn't sort of go, no, listen, Russell.
No.
They pulled Christina aside and told her.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, mainly it was my diet. People, you know, I like to joke that marijuana got me out of a wheelchair, but mainly it's the diet. It's what I, and mainly what I don't eat rather than what I do eat.
Okay.
You know, I don't eat things that are deep fried. I don't eat, you know, white bread. I don't eat dairy. I don't eat beef. You know, I don't eat carbonated anything or any sort of artificial sweeteners and no sugars and stuff, just fruit juice and you know, raisins and apples.
And all of that has helped you get the fibromyalgia under control?
Well, you know, it's taken a lot of the edge off. And so this is why when people are like, oh, wow, you know, because they'll see me and I'm, you know, I'm 46 and I have good skin and I'm, you know, sort of seem clear-eyed and I'm not on any pharmaceuticals. So they're like, wow, you know, how do you stay looking this good? And they'll say, well, you know, you got to eat this stuff and avoid this stuff. And they sort of, you know, I say, well, and then I use a lot of marijuana and they sort of pep up after that. Well, I like the marijuana part.
But that strict diet part, that's not so attractive, but the marijuana part looks interesting.
Yeah. Well, see, this is the thing. I regard marijuana as a health product. I don't regard it as a recreational thing. Even if I have enough to get stoned, like sort of uncomfortably stoned.
Yes.
Even when smoked, the benefits of using marijuana far outweigh any dangers. So, you know, even when you're doing dabs, for example, and you can get, you know, pretty loopy after, if you have a big dab or too many dabs in too short a time, all you're really doing is getting a bit loopy. You're not doing any damage to your brain. You're not doing any damage to your body. You're basically getting embarrassed in front of your friends.
Yeah, that's the extent of it.
So, well, this is the thing. A lot of people are worried about this new stuff. You know, it's concentrates and this dab oil that people use. And if you take a big one and you're not sort of able to metabolize that, you can get really nauseous and get the cold sweats and pass out. And it's very uncomfortable. I mean, it can make the next 2 hours of your life just terrible.
Okay.
But that's it. You're embarrassed and you feel gross because it's like eating a whole tin of cookie dough at once. You know, a couple of spoonfuls is not that good, not that big a deal. But if you eat the whole tin, you're going to be feeling sick.
You're going to pay for it.
Right. So this is my, you know, my agenda is have marijuana sold for all ages. And we use education to teach kids about responsible use and this kind of thing.
How to manage
it. We're only talking about 15% of kids ages 10 to 18 anyway. We're not talking about a huge portion of every school class.
Right.
Meanwhile, obesity is a serious problem in Canada for kids.
Yes. Yeah. You know. It's very, very serious.
You know, depression, bullying, anxiety. I mean, they're growing up in a completely different world than we did with the electronics and the different kind of culture that we live in now with the electronic culture and the internet culture.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff they take for granted. This is Star Trek to me. Skype.
Yeah.
You know, video telephone.
It's, yeah. Yeah. You know. Exactly.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think education is the best way to do it, because through education is how we've reduced the number of tobacco users in our country, not through legislation and enforcement.
Yeah. Really good point. I think we'll leave it there, Russell. We'll really appreciate you taking the time this evening to connect with us and to bring us up to date on, where the campaign is at in terms of getting public acceptance and getting the politicians to pay attention and the legislators and whatnot, and also really making that point that we're not talking about legalizing anything here. We're just talking about removing the barriers to letting people use it in a safe and healthy way and just getting on with it.
They could do it with one signature. They do not need to pass a bill through the House.
Yeah, there you go. Well, this message needs to get out, and hopefully we're doing our little part here to let the public know that this is not as complicated as it may appear out there as a part of the big war on drugs that is costing us billions of dollars. So thanks again for making yourself available to us this evening and for sharing this really interesting information. And we wish you all the best, Russell.
All right, thanks. Anytime.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.